Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. No set schedule, just whenever I happen to finish a book, I will just happen to review it and just happen to put it up on the podcast feed. I always say this at the beginning, mainly to stop people complaining. Normally to stop them complaining, going, oh, it's been 3 weeks since you've put up a podcast. And this time I think it's like, oh, you're putting up too many podcasts because I've managed to finish 3 books within 7 days. Or this is my third review within 7 days. So I hope you're enjoying the more filled schedule here. First of all, some feedback. Yeah, it seems like the longer episodes that I've been doing recently, they're sticking around for a while longer. I actually started this podcast thinking I'd be doing reviews around about 5 to 10 minutes, you know, just a quick summary of the book, a few things that I enjoyed about it, and then my rating at the end out of 5 stars, stolen from Amazon.com, of course, because they always do 5 out of 5 star reviews there as well. But I actually enjoy doing these longer podcasts a whole lot more because I can really get into the books. If I really love a book, I can get into all the things I love about it. And if I really dislike a book, or if I'm not satisfied with the element of a book, I can really go on a long rant about it. So also, really, I'm really glad for getting all the feedback from you people, the listeners out there, because I'm getting plenty of suggestions of books to read in the future and review in the future. And that's another reason why I started this off, just, of course, because I like talking about science fiction books and I like podcasting, but also I really want to sort of widen out my my scope of science fiction reading. And this podcast and all you people listening and sending in suggestions have really been a big help with that. So if you've got any more suggestions and you want me to try out some different styles of science fiction, just send an email to luke@juggler.net. So, quickly, on to today's book. It's called Down the Bright Way by Robert Reed. And I actually read and reviewed another book of his earlier on this year called Marrow. And that Marrow was from 2000 or 2001. And I said last episode that Wikipedia was full of shit because it said Down the Bright Way was the sequel to Marrow, and it isn't the sequel to Marrow. But instead, actually, last time I recorded this, I said last week, it was like 3 days ago, whenever it was, I didn't actually have internet access at the time, so I couldn't check what I was saying about Wikipedia. And actually, Wikipedia was right, and I'm the one who's full of shit. Down the Bright Way is not the sequel to Marrow. But nobody said it was. It was just in my head as it when I picked it up. So, if you've not listened to the review that I did of Marrow before this one, I will mention a few things about Marrow, but no spoilers, and you don't actually have to have read it. I'm sure you'll follow. No problem at all. So, Robert Reed wrote this book in 1991. It's one of his first novels, I guess, from what I've seen of his Wikipedia page that I remember of it. So, the universe is this. It's completely different from Marrow. It's not a follow-up. It's not at all in the same universe. The setup goes a bit like this. The Bright Way is... No, I'll start a bit earlier than that. So, about 4 million years ago, there was this... these people or some kind of things called the Makers, and we're never really quite sure what they are. They're like the gods, you know, the powerful precursors in this universe to what we actually read about here. And they created what was known as the Bright. And the Bright is this mysterious path that links alternative universes. But these alternative universes don't start way back at the Big Bang. They start around about 4 million years ago. So the Bright was, it sort of connects all of the Earths that have sprung up since then. But, you know, you're not actually sure how many Earths are there, and they're only connected in specific places. So 4 million years ago, there was a single Earth line, and then it split off into unknown number of Earth lines. And each of these Earths continued, and they change in small ways, and these small changes build up over time. And so 4 million years later, which is today in this book, the Bright links lots and lots of unknown Earths, you know, millions. And actually nobody knows actually how many Earths are linked together by the Bright. And the Bright is this kind of force field kind of weird thing that exists outside of the known universe. It reminded me a little bit of the Isaac Asimov book, At the End of Eternity, where you can sort of step outside of time and all time is connected by this place that connects the through thread. This doesn't work in the time dimension, it works in the alternate universe dimension, but it sort of exists outside of space and time as we know it. Like you say, all these Earths are joined up, but the Bright is actually away. It's not a single place, and all Earths are connected to the single place. It's like a string. So from our Earth, we can go to the one ahead of us and one behind of us, or one side of us or one to the other side of us. but we can only go there. And then from one of these ones, you can go further and push forward into another Earth, and then into another Earth, or into another Earth. Or you can turn around and come back along the chain, back to your starting point. And each of these worlds, as I said before, they've all got their own history and their own evolution, and some proto-human kind of people. They developed in one, or they were already sort of half-developed, you know, a few million years after the split from humans and chimpanzees. And so these proto-humans sort of develop into other people, very much like us in some cases, and other proto-humans evolve in different directions, and some are more intelligent and less intelligent, and some are pure vegetarians, and others, you know, are still hunters and gatherers. If you read the book, there's many more far interesting variations of humans discussed in the book, and I don't really want to spoil it here. So it did actually remind me again of another science fiction book, Ringworld, the Ringworld series, because there's lots and lots of different breeds of human, and they all have different functions, and they all are slight, you know, sometimes slight variations, sometimes big variations of each other, and yet all still human, from the same like baseline human stock. And I guess that's what this book is as well. One of the human lines, or one of the sort of proto-human lines, develops into people called the Founders, and they evolved a very high level technology. Well, they didn't evolve high level technology, they evolved high level intelligence, and from there got a high level of technology. And that all happened about a million years ago, and they discovered the Bright by accident, and they realized what they'd found, and they went on this mission. And this mission had two purposes. One was to find the makers, these godlike beings that had made the Bright in the first place, and ask them, hey, why did you build the Bright? And the other mission, I guess, is to, they have to, or what they want to do is actually sort of help all of the Earths along the way. So each Earth that they get to, they stop there and sort of try and encourage the humans to stop killing themselves in big wars, or to give them more technologies, or just to help them with space flight and help them get to different worlds, and to Mars and to terraform Mars, because they've all done this. You know, they've come to so many different worlds that they have a lot of technology and a lot of wisdom to share with the rest of the Earths that they visit. And The mission is called the Wanderers, or the people on the mission are called Wanderers, and the people who join the mission as they go along, they're called Wanderers as well, because they wander along the Bright, and also they wander around on each Earth. So once they get to Earth, they wander around and try and find a lot about Earth as they can. And of course, the Wanderers, they use advanced technology to stay alive as long as they want to. And it gets to the point where Jai, the founder and the leader of the Wanderers mission, is about a million years old and still alive and still leading the mission. And she's visited, or like the Wanderers mission has visited, around about 500,000 Earths in total up until this point. Again, that's a big setup that I've given you there. That's all pretty much outlined in the first two chapters of the book. So I'm not spoiling anything here. The story actually starts a few months after the Wanderers have turned up to our Earthline, as in the Earth, not anybody else's Earth, our Earth, in sort of like 20th century Earth, you know. And we read about what's happening, and you know, the reaction of the UN and the US and these other groups, and you know, we find out what the world is like after the introduction of these benign guides from different dimensions. And we get this actually from the point of view of a wanderer called Kyle. And we read about how Kyle, this wanderer, he's come to Earth, and he's fallen for this Earth girl called Billy. And, you know, he's fallen in love with her. And we find out that Jai, the leader of the Wanderers, is actually coming to the city where Billy lives and where Kyle is staying there with Billy. And, of course, Jai, as the leader of the Wanderers, is pretty much the most powerful person on around about 500,000 different Earthlines. And of course, so she's an important person. She's coming to visit the city and to do a big rally. So Billy asks Kyle if he can arrange it so Billy can actually meet up with Jai after the rally in the city. And Kyle doesn't want to say yes, but he goes yes. And then he immediately regrets it, because at that point, we're only about like three chapters in, but we find out that Kyle isn't actually who he says he is. He says he's a wanderer, but in fact, he's not a wanderer at all. He's just someone who decided to dress up as a wanderer one day because he thought, oh, I wonder what happened if I act like a wanderer. And he realized that suddenly he stood out. He was someone special, and he was treated well by other people, you know, people who had never even noticed him before, because he was wearing and talking and looking like a wanderer. Suddenly they were really impressed with him and treated him differently. So he stuck at a charade, and and that's it. And actually, it's a really, really great introduction to the book, an introduction to a character. I wish I didn't sort of have to spoil it, but to talk more about the book, I've really sort of got to talk about that a bit more. It's just a great character introduction, and really well executed as well. So it's a minor spoiler, but it's not really a spoiler because it happens on like page 20 of a like 360 page long book here, so I can't really call it a spoiler. So the first section of the book is taken up pretty much with the story of Kyle trying to get Billy in to meet Jai after this big rally that happens in their city. And but he doesn't. He really doesn't want to reveal to Billy that he isn't actually a sort of an alien human from another Earth, and he doesn't want to reveal to the real Wanderers that he isn't a Wanderer either. So it's actually really engaging for me. I found it a real good fun to read because the tension is right there. Every word that Kyle says and every action that he makes, you know, all the time, I was on the edge of my seat, figuratively speaking, of course, not knowing if the next thing he said or did would give it all away, give him away completely. But that, of course, isn't the only thing going on. Every three chapters, or every three or four chapters in the book, the limited third-person narrative changes to somebody else. And it's actually something I really like in fiction, because we get to explore the same world through different narrow perspectives, you know, because it goes from only one person's point of view and only with their knowledge to only one other person's point of view to only one other person's knowledge as well. And the thing is, in most books, the characters are doing different things at different times in different places, you know, and because you're spread out a long way, that you're actually seeing different events through different eyes. Whereas in Down the Bright Way, about a third of the way through, all the characters come together. And then they follow the same storyline with the same plot, but we actually keep reading about it in different sections from different people. So, like, you know, all the time... Oh, wait a second, I'll actually just explain it a bit more, actually, because the different characters that we go through, of course, is Kyle. A bit later in the book, we get Billy, and, you know, we see the eyes through the world of Billy, of course. But it turns out that, you know, she is beautiful and sexy, but she also might be a little bit dim and naive. That's the kind of things that I got from her as well. Of course, you see the world through Jai herself. She is the big mama of the Wanderers mission. She's the one who came up with the idea of the mission in the first place and is over a million years old. We get to see the world through the eyes of Quense, I think that's how you pronounce his name, and he's a member of Jai's inner circle, and he's like a rising star in the Wanderers' leadership kind of council as well. And he's very competent, but maybe a bit arrogant. And other people in Jai's entourage are quite jealous of him as well, especially a woman called Wish, who he works with, and a man named Zen, who are also main characters in the book. But we don't actually see the world through their eyes. We don't see the plot from their perspective. And they all work quite closely with Jai in her entourage. Those are the good guys that we follow, but there's also two villains in the novel too. There's Cotton, who is this special kind of human called a termite. On his world that he comes from, everyone lives in these huge colonies, and there's this strict caste system, which I actually quite liked a lot when it was described in the book. It's all based on how much food you can eat. The less you eat, the slower your metabolism is. So while you don't have a lot of energy or intelligence, you live for hundreds of years. And then there's the very rich who eat a lot because they can afford to eat a lot, and eating a lot makes you feel really good, and they're quick and strong, but they burn through their entire life in around about 30 or 40 years. And Cotton, he comes from this middle caste, but he isn't a wanderer in the book, so you're wondering, what's he doing here on Earth, and how did he get here? And it turns out he is employed by the last character that we follow closely, and that is Moliak. And Moliak is this mysterious bad guy. And as soon as you meet him, you sort of find out that his motives are quite all over the place. You're not quite sure what he's doing or why he's the bad guy. But he has these nightmares about this group called the Unfound. And again, we're not quite sure who the Unfound is or what he's doing in our Earth line. Or why what he's doing sort of warrants extreme measures. But there we go. So, like I say, in turn, we get to know these characters. But the thing I really like about it is because we follow the same story, or most of the book follows the same story, where all the characters are involved, when something happens, you're always thinking, ah, I was just with this other guy, I was just with Kyle. Why, Kyle is seeing this as well as me. What is Kyle thinking in this situation? Or what is Quent seeing now? You know, Kyle is seeing it this way, but Quent must see it something else. And Jai is seeing the same thing. What's her perspective of this? And we don't always know it all the way through, but because we know the characters so well and because they're all experiencing the same kind of thing all the time, it's like we're getting their side of the story, or we're imagining their side of the story. And another good thing is that, which is quite expertly done here, is that we don't stay with any character for too long. You know, there's always like this perfect number of pages. You set off with them and you sort of fall into their pace and you follow them just far enough. And just before it's going to get boring and you're thinking, oh, well, what is this other person going to think? Oh, well, I really want to know what this person is going to do now or is going to think now. Then it skips to that person. It's a very natural flow to the book. And it's a pleasure to read, like I said. It's very much a character study, but it spans six characters at once. You know, even if you're not following the narrative from that person's point of view, you're still getting the other people's characters, and I think that's really good stuff. So back to the story, I guess. Jai, she makes a speech at a rally in Billy's hometown and then goes backstage to meet up with the local Earth people. And Quensei has actually picked all of the Earth people that she's going to meet, and Zen and Wish are involved there as well. So, of course, Kyle is bringing Billy to see her, and Moliak and Cotton have their own agenda, so they're coming to see her as well. And I don't really want to spoil it, because from then on, that's where things really, really pick up. Even though before then it's very interesting, that's where, of course, we get the journey down the Bright Way, which is the book is named after, and we see many alternative worlds and hijinks ensue, as you can say. And of course, we get to know a lot more about Jai and Quensei, and we find out the story behind Cotton and Moliak, and who are the Unfound. And by the end of the book, you've got a whole new mission for the Wanderers as well. The story is actually really good. I've just got to wrap this up now, actually, with the story. Really, really good. The other book by Robert Reed that I read, Marrow, it had this sprawling world and this sprawling plot. Things were happening here, and then you cut across to here, and then these people are doing that, and then you cut across, and then this big battle scene that happens here. Then you cut back, and the battle scene doesn't really matter because we're going to do this instead now. This book, though, even though it spans like 500,000 Earths, and you know there's these massive, you know, big things that are happening, and what is actually happening is like massively important to the history of 500,000 Earths. It's the spectrum that you cover, or the sort of like the field that you cover in the book is actually very narrow. All the time there's this clear destination in mind, and it's always with this small group of people, and they're racing towards it. You know, they're going down the Bright Way, and they're heading to one destination. And the plot, it's complex, but it's not overly complex. It's just about right, you know. Put it another way, like, this is one of Robert Reed's earliest novels, and it really feels like he has a good idea here, and he's going to stick to it. Whereas in Marrow is obviously a later book, and it sort of, I wouldn't say it flounders all over the place, but it does seem to wander all over the place, whereas this book, with the Wanderers, you follow it very, very clearly. The one thing I do have a bit of a sore point is right at the very end, there's this one thing that happens. There's this character who makes a decision, and I'm thinking, that's a bit too simplistic. You know, he wouldn't do that. You know, why do they do that? And I think, oh, I know what's going to happen, and that thing did happen. It was just, you know, it was written that it's like this character was just a moment of sloppiness, that he would never normally do that, but there he just did it. And this character, you think, well, he's as old as he is. He should never, you know, if he'd have made any mistake like that in his past, he wouldn't exist anymore. He'd have been killed or something would happen. And yet he just makes that mistake. And it's not a sloppy character thing. It seems to just be a bit of sloppy writing. Also, a main complaint of mine, no matter what happens in the book, sometimes it'll just be resolved by a punch-out or a shootout between the main hero and the main bad guy. And that does, I wouldn't say it happens in this book. It's sort of a shade of that kind of thing happens in this book, but it fits because the main conflict throughout the book is at very close quarters. Like I say, there's the bad guys and the good guys, and they're in close quarters throughout most of the book. So of course it's going to, like, the conflict is going to be resolved in that kind of way. It makes sense. And the characters' motivations at the end, like, make sense as well, especially Jai. When you actually read about her final motivation of why she did what she did in one of the final scenes, you find out just a few pages afterwards, you actually think, yeah, I understand now. It makes a lot of sense there as well. Actually, on a tangent, there's this someone sent me an email after me complaining in the book Black Man about, you know, this whole thing of mine about how, you know, the conflict in the book, like, main conflict in the book is always resolved by punching and shooting each other. And actually, the email went a bit like this. I don't have it in front of me now, but it went, they said, but June, at the end of June, that you gave us such a glowing review to, at the end of June, Paul Atreides fights the Feyd Ruther, so the main sort of guy from the Harkonnen camp, you know, the young guy who's meant to be taking over the Harkonnen, House Harkonnen, and they just fight each other at the end. And why didn't you sort of pull up that pointer there? Because the main thing in this book, again, a bit of a tangent here, is that the main conflict in the book of Dune had already been resolved using atomics on the shield wall, and then they all ride in on the sandworms and Paul Atreides takes over. And you know that atomics are forbidden against people, but Paul deployed them against the rock and then he let the sandstorm do his work for us, sort of giving away the end of Dune, but hey, you should have read it by now. And the book is, you know, that kind of like conflict resolution there is really clever and fits perfectly with sort of like the large sweeping militaristic themes of the book and Paul's training for before then and how he's lived in the desert up until then on Arrakis. And the point of the single combat at the end of the book in Dune is mainly for honor. He didn't have to fight Faedruthu, but because he was in a position of complete power over everybody in that situation. At that time, he had the power of life and death of everybody in the room in his hand. But he had to fight Faedruthu because of the laws of the rules of Canley, as it's called in the book. He couldn't legitimately take over the position of emperor of the galaxy or emperor of the empire there without fighting Faedruthu, because he wouldn't be legitimate at all. Canley means that he couldn't use atomics, but also he had to resolve disputes without harming innocents, and that meant when Faedruthu, his main enemy, said, "I want one-on-one single combat," he had to do that to fulfill the rules of Canley, and it was logical within the universe. He didn't have to himself, you know, the plot didn't call for it, and yet he did it anyway because he couldn't do one thing. He couldn't use the atomics not against people but against the shield wall and then not fight Faedruthu at the end. It was just part of the overall logic. But then you contrast that with, say, The Prefect by Alistair what's his name? Alistair, sorry, it's just completely dropped out my head there. I'm going to have to look this up very quickly. By Alistair Reynolds. Wow, so I've completely dropped out of my head there. Yeah, so in his book, what you have is that at the end of it, there could have been lots of different things that the prefect, our main hero, could have done, but he just decides his best course of action is to go in and go up against the main guy one-on-one. And he didn't actually have to do that, and it didn't make any sense for him to do that. It wasn't the best course of action. It was completely illogical. But he seemed to do it just because it's easy to write one-on-one battles, and they're really handy at the end of novels when you're a bit of a sloppy writer, or if you're going to write a book sloppily, to wrap up loose ends, because the bad guy is always dead. And the good guy always has this real triumph, and he can listen to the bad guy's monologue, wrap up all the ends of the story, and a big shootout, and that's great. You know, a real triumph at the end for the main protagonist. In Black Man, you wear Karl Marsalis. He has no motivations at the end except that he wants to go kill people because he hasn't killed those people yet. You know, everything was resolved there. It's just that he had to sort of wrap up the very end loose ends. It's in other words, sort of, if two bad guys are still living and Karl Marsalis hasn't killed them yet. And there's no logic to these things. You know, nothing in the rest of the book sets up these resolutions to the conflict. It's just, it's like an easy and cheap way out for the authors. It's like I said, you know, let the bad guy monologue, then kill him. Triumph for protagonist, death for antagonist. Thank you very much for opening up the book. And I just don't see that that Dune is along those lines at all. Sure, there is a one-on-one combat at the end, but it's just got so many other reasons. And like I say, the main conflict of the book is already resolved by that point. It serves another function in the book. Anyway, tangent over. Sorry about going on for 5 minutes, but I thought I'd just answer that email there. So keep sending in your other emails. I'll answer them as maybe at the beginning or end of podcast, maybe like this, just halfway through as a tangent. I wasn't meaning to go off on a tangent like that. Anyway, where was I? Yes, in this book, the ending does make a lot of sense considering the revelations and the motivations up until that point. Like I say, except for that one key decision by that one character. But I can forgive it because I enjoyed the book so much up until that point. Let me talk a little bit about the technology. As in Marrow, humans have incredibly long lives. Of course, not us humans, but the Wanderers have incredibly long lives to the order of hundreds of thousands of years each. Some of them millions, of course, or one of them up to a million, some of them just hundreds, some of them hundreds of thousands. And the people, how they live that long isn't actually explained in any depth in the book or at all, actually, if I remember. We're just told, considering how powerful the Wanderers are and how high technology they have, they can live as long as they want to. And I'm just thinking, okay, yeah. At one point it does mention that, you know, parts of their DNA was scrubbed and they were given new, like, new youth in this kind. But again, it's not explained at all. It's like the opposite of hard science fiction. But in this book, that's not a bad thing. Also, like in Marrow, a lot of thought has gone into sort of the memories and how they deal with their memories. One thing I like is that each Wanderer has a soft memory, which is pretty much their biological brain, which may or may not be augmented in any way, but it's biological brain. And then they have the hard memory, which is like a hard drive or flash memory disk, which is in their skull. And in there, they back up all of the important stuff. And it's shown that memories exist in the hard brain, but characters and personality exist in the soft brain. And I really like that idea and some of the things that it goes into about it. Not into much depth in this book, but just that idea. I'd have actually liked to have seen a bit more of that explored. And another thing that it has in common with Marrow, really, is that a slight complaint. I didn't really feel that the long lives of the character came through in the writing. You know, it's far better than Marrow because, you know, the characters are more rounded and they're more satisfying to read about. But I still want a character. You know, if the character's lived a million years, the writing in this book really didn't convince me of that. You know, I could see that they were old, you know, maybe 100 years old or a few hundred years old. That's the kind of feeling that I got, that they've been doing their job for hundreds of years. But, like, if someone's doing the same job for hundreds of thousands of years, these people either have no imagination, they're just like robots or something, or they're just bloody-minded to the point of, I don't know, insanity. Whereas in this book, you get a glimpse of that, but I really want more, and I think it's just missing the mark a bit. Or maybe I'm missing the mark, and I just don't understand what it's like to live hundreds of thousands for years at a time. Another cool technology, I guess there's this thing called the fighting glove, and it's made from nanoparticles. I don't really want to spoil it because, you know, the descriptions of where it comes from is very interesting and very cool. I don't really want to spoil that. The biggest piece of technology in this book, my note here, is, of course, the Bright itself. You know, where did it come from? What's it doing here? Is it explained at all? Not really. Just a big, dumb object in the vein of big, dumb objects. I guess that's the nomenclature in science fiction. It's there, and it's going to make the story interesting, but we don't really need to know all that much about it except that it's there. Like I say, very little hard science behind anything in this book. Which in other books actually is a bad thing. Example, Marrow. It was a bad thing that there wasn't much hard science behind it or much logic behind it because, you know, you've got a big ship, and it's a big ship, and it's a bit like this, but the descriptions didn't always make sense, and they left me sort of scratching my head a bit. It's like, yeah, I want to know really what's powering this thing, you know, and really what's going on here. And, you know, actually, while I was reading Marrow, it didn't really seem to be that much of a problem because it was like a big adventure and it was fun to read. But as I look back on it, you know, as I was going on through the book, sort of had more and more questions. And then when the book finished and there was new technology introduced sort of out of the blue and other things that came in, I just looked back at it in frustration. Even though I sort of enjoyed the book while I was reading it, I had to give it a low score of 2.5 just because when I'd finished looking back, it just didn't satisfy me at all. However, in Down the Bright Way, the scope of the novel is far narrower, as I said. And again, this is not a bad thing, because the world is set up at the beginning, and while it doesn't make sense, like, the Bright, I mean, what is it, and why does it follow these rules, I don't really care, I'll just go with it. The Makers are powerful as gods, I don't need to understand them. The logic follows perfectly, or what follows in the book follows the logic perfectly. New ideas are introduced throughout the book, but each has a perfectly, if not believable, a perfectly harmonious explanation to what has gone before. And I think that's harmonious. I think that's probably what Marrow was missing. You know, a new thing, something else would come up, and it just didn't have, you know, it didn't sit in place very well. Whereas this book, it sets up a real world and explores it. I guess the best way to think about this, which I sort of thought of while I was reading it, is like, if you read a novel set in World War II, you don't need to explain how planes work. You don't need to explain who invented the tank or why they invented the tank. You just go, okay, tanks exist in this book, and we'll go with it. But if a book is about World War II, and suddenly there's a bouncing bomb from the Dambusters, you really got to explain what the bouncing bomb is, because it's like a new paradigm. Or if, like, the atomic bombs go off in Japan, you've got to explain to the characters and you've got to explain to the people reading the atomic bomb, because, you know, the people there don't understand where it's coming from. What I'm trying to say really is that, you know, once you set up the world, if a new technology comes along, you've got to explain that shift in paradigm, you know, to, you know, employ a cliche there. Thankfully, this book, it doesn't have many of these shifts in paradigms. And when they do come along, it's like, of course, a logical outgrowth of what comes before. And one of the main things, of course, is, or one main interesting thing that allows this to happen is that a character a million years old has many, many, many secrets. And these are brought out throughout the book. And I really like that. So, you know, the technology, well, it's not a technology, of course. The evolution of different lines of humans is, of course, interesting. And they all have their own impact on the story. And if they don't have a big impact on the story, we just sort of hear about them and then we move on briskly. They don't sort of dwell on it a lot. I guess finally, to wrap up the review, normally I go into the themes of the book I'm reviewing. With this book, I guess there's quite a few themes, but not anyone stands out really sharply from the rest, or not even a few do, because I'm not really sure what to say. I guess it's like, because we're always following these six different characters, each of the characters has a different focus and a different theme. For example, Cotton, the sort of the termite henchman, he's like a pacifist, and you sort of, you know, Moliak, his boss that who he works for, almost loses him at one point because he uses violence, and that's really upsetting to Cotton. But then as the book goes on, more things are revealed, and at the end of the book, well, of course you'll see what happens to Cotton and his view on the life and the world at the end. I guess Jai, the main leader of the Wanderers, she's always focused, and it's, you know, her her theme is like duty and faith and serving a higher cause. And yet it's flipped around at the end as well, and it's like, okay, what is the higher cause? Or is she the higher cause? You know, other people working for her, and yet she's working for something else. Or is she, you know? And Moliak's thread has the opposite themes, you know, of losing faith and finding other motivations, of like the opposite from Jai. And then Kyle and Quensay, they have two different opposite looks at identity and how you are perceived by others and how you perceive yourself. For example, Kyle looks at it from the point of view who's, you know, working really hard and pretending to be something he isn't, and succeeding really well at something he isn't, but he isn't that thing, you know, it's just a facade. Whereas Quensay comes from the opposite view. He's working hard to be something, and yet other people don't view him as he views himself. For example, Zen and Wish's view of Quensay is different from Quensay's view of himself again. And it's these sort of opposite ways of looking at these same themes of duty and faith and identity. And I just really liked it. Again, I don't really know how to like use examples from the book without spoiling it and to go into any more details, but I'm just saying that like these, you know, these themes, because there were so many of them, they're sort of washing around in the book, sort of more like a background of reality, of real issues and emotions that I can engage with me, even though they're zipping along in this sort of, like, hyperdimensional bubble in, you know, different dimensions. It's all really silly technology, because there's this sort of, like, background grounding in issues and emotions, I can really grab onto it. But then again, it is more of an adventure story and an exploration story. But it's a good one. I really like it. So it's much, much better than Marrow. And actually a lot better than I was expecting. Because I was thinking, oh, you know, I enjoyed, you know, Marrow quite a bit. And I'd like to see what happens here as well. But, you know, the pace of this book is just, it's perfect. And the story is really good. And the characters are really good fun. And they're really engaging. And, you know, they develop so much over the course of the book. That's what the book really is. It's like a six-person character study. And all the six people are from different Earths as well, which makes it very interesting. And we get to find out why they're really doing what they're doing. And all the way through. And it's really good in that respect. So I'm going to give this book 4 stars out of 5. I would give it a little bit more. But like I say, there is a few like smaller issues that I have with this book, which do spoil it for me. I'd give it a little bit. It's more than four stars. I'd give it 4.2 stars out of 5, which means that you should really check this book out. It's a real treat. I was really surprised by it, and I think you would be too. Really good. So, 4.2. The next book I'm going to read is, or I actually just started it, I've not really got that far into it, Snow Crash by Neil Stevenson. Now, this book, the reason I'm reading it, it was recommended by the Geek Nights podcast Book Club. And Geek Nights is this really, really geeky podcast about all different kinds of things. I mainly listen for the board game and the technology and some of the gaming kind of things. Because they have different topics on different nights. On Thursdays, though, they cover all kinds of different topics, including a book club. I read a previous recommendation of theirs called The Prince of Nothing, but it was a fantasy novel, so I didn't actually review it for this podcast. But this novel is Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson, and it's science fiction. So, of course, if I read a science fiction book, for whatever reason, I'm going to review it here. They actually said, hey, read it. And they said that like months and months ago, but they never actually got round to doing their own review of the book. And it was only actually after I bought the book myself, because it was a long way back in my list of books that I want to read, I actually started reading it. And now they've put out their review, although I haven't listened to it yet, because they say there's massive spoilers. So you can either check out their podcast about it or just wait a bit and I'll review it with no spoilers. Or very, 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 very few spoilers, as what is the kind of thing I like to do. But it does come highly recommended by two uber geeks. And that's all really I know about it at the moment, although I have read other Neal Stephenson works before. And then after that, I'll read and review The Dreaming Void by Peter F. Hamilton, another next part in one of his epic trilogies. And so that's about it. Email me, luke@juggler.net, with any book suggestions, or if you have any opinions on the way I'm reviewing books or anything like that, keep sending them in. I do change to what kind of things that I do here to more what people like. Sorry, I'm a bit tired now. It's very late at night. I'm rambling now. So otherwise, yeah, check out the wiki, sfbrp.com, and check out the wiki there. Add book suggestions and look up all the other things that I've done there. So anyway, thanks for listening and catch you later.